Accession number 19922, Reel 2.
Barry Smith, Reel 2. I think you've got some details you can give about your training in Germany.
Yes, it was my first recollections, apart from all the normal training of being trained to become an accomplished shot with the armaments we had at that time, 303 Lee Enfield rifle, whatever they call it now, and the Sten and Vickers Piat, being able to fire a Bren gun in a competent manner, and being able to assemble it in the dark or blindfolded. If they took one piece away, you know that it was missing.
You were telling me about the training.
Well, yes. Do you want me to go over about the being able to be a competent shot with a rifle and Bren gun?
Right.
Well, yes. So we were trained in all the usual armaments, being a competent shot. All of the normal field training, with Sten, Bren, etc., etc. Know all the perfect workings of it, and so if you were caught in a situation, you would be entirely able on your own to get yourself out of trouble. You would be totally, you could go on your own initiative. The training was quite harsh in that sense, but at that time, because you were the first battalion, it wasn't something new to you at that time, and there was quite a lot of camaraderie, you know, ambience in battalion, that we were first class regiment, and you became part of this, whether you liked it or not, you know. When I became a signaller, qualified as a signaller, when we went on the manoeuvres, you were sent out on manoeuvres in, say, a Bren gun carrier with an 18 set, which is quite a big transmitter, the same set as they had in the Centurion tanks at that time, exactly the same. And you were given a map, and you had a driver and a colleague, and you were all sent off in different directions. And then you had to crash in on the radio net to establish your position, and that you'd reached a certain map reference. And then you were sent to another map reference and what have you. And all the radio tests and peculiarities and faults were ironed out, and you were trained in this manner. You became very competent as a radio operator, as a map reader, and as a general infantryman. In my training, as a Sergeant Sheridan, I think he was Jewish, but a bit of a comedian, but he was very strict, and he said, the first thing he said to us, he said, that I didn't think it was would affect me at the time. You don't when you're National Service. He said that I must tell you, before we start this course, as you prospective signallers, that, and the words went in so many words, not his exact words, in so many words, as I remember it, that you will be put with an officer. Your job is highly important. You're his right-hand man. You're his communication. And it all rests on you, and you'll be expected to know exactly what to do and to do it 100% when you're asked. And this is why I'm going to train you thoroughly now. He said, in the event of going into active service, with you or with an officer, I must tell you this, that if anyone wants to come out of this course now, they can do, because if you're in action, you're one of the first people they will try and take out, the communications. I don't know how he viewed this. We thought, well, you know, going into that, if it's just by the way, we let that pass over our heads. Whether we took that as would happen or as an exaggeration, I don't know. But it was his way of saying that this was quite a serious position you were in now. It wasn't a job which is just sitting in a trench. This was something vastly different. It was that as well. Your job was very important, and other people would rely on you. That is to say, you were their lifeline. And to fail in this duty, not to do, or to miss out in not doing your duty properly, you were letting all the others down as well. It's quite a responsible position. He tried to hammer this into us. It also had its very funny side. The thing is, he would send you down to the stores to get a tuning and netting whistle. Well, this is purely a harmonic thing. It's only caused by pushing various buttons, and you get a signal coming over the air, which you then tune into. It's rather like a moustache. It goes up and then down into sound, then up again. Like woo, woo, like that. And you get right down in the middle, and you're on channel. And then it'll come up, and they'll ask you to report in. He can tell you then if you're on the signal. Well, it's purely a harmonic thing. It's not a thing you can pick up physically. And of course, this was the thing that used to go on. He'd go down, and the champion chap of the stores would say, "Oh, right, there we are." And he'd give you this tuning and netting whistle, which is something like a small battery like this, or a fuse, and you take it back and you proudly give it to the sergeant. "There we are, sergeant, tuning and netting whistle." And he said, "Now I'm going to tell you what a real tuning and netting whistle is." That is one way of making you see the point, or getting your attention, to drive it into you, in other words. This is a tuning and netting whistle. I'll now tell you what it is. It's a harmonic thing. In other words, if anyone had been a bit ignorant there, you know, what they meant by harmonic, or, a radio thing, it would become more apparent, you know? Because you couldn't, or I suppose a training sergeant, you wouldn't know if you had any prior knowledge or intelligence to figure it out for yourself, you know? They can't teach you everything. You've got to have a little bit of your own intelligence, these things. Anyway, where were we?
You were just telling me about the training that you were having in West Germany.
Then obviously after that you went on, so like the Rhine Army manoeuvres, so we would go out on one of the places I remember, which is the old German training ground, which is Sennelager. I think that's not far from Nuremberg Heath. But we would go out as a unit, and it was training in the true battle sense. You went out and you had to go into action against another regiment, and they would have referees to see if you acquitted yourself well. This is proper battle training. This, you probably know about this. They do this today, I dare say, with regiments, to run you over a real situation. Also in my training, we were trained under live ammunition as well. They would fire over your heads while you attacked or advanced to a position. That is, I was a signaller, I'd be with the officer, and we're with a company or a platoon, and we would go out and what have you. And all the signals of manoeuvres, of battle, of officers' commands were very familiar to me. I'd now relay these to the network and what have you. And you also use your own initiative. If something came up on the radio, you would acknowledge it and report this to the officer and what have you. If you thought it was of importance to him, etc. And all the platoons, this is if you were, when you're sector off in a company, in charge of signals, the platoons' radio sets will be knitted into you as well. So you're responsible, any communication coming back. So you would, the battle plan would go right through yourself, as or whatever it is or was.
Now, did you go to Korea from West Germany?
Yes, another quirk of fate. I was sent back with a group of about 100 to Canterbury, and we were put in charge, I think he was an East Surrey sergeant, and he had us all on the parade ground. We were there to be sent to the East Surreys for onward transfer. This is, the army used to do things that way. They used to transfer you from regiment to regiment, or where they needed men, in other words. And I was transferred to, we were going to be transferred to the East Surreys. We changed all our flashes on our uniforms. We didn't want to be East Surreys. We were very proud of being Fusiliers. And it was rather special. You may realise, or may know, that the majority of us were Londoners. Some of them had been Londoners living in the same street. In my case, I had three fellas I knew very well. One of them, or a couple of them, were killed in Korea. They actually came from the same area as myself in North London. What became of them after that, God only knows. But we happened to come from the same area. So there was a certain, you were Londoners. Although my family came from Hertfordshire, I was living in London at that time, or London broadly speaking. There was a certain amount of, we were very proud of our regiment, and we didn't want to become, we were then fully trained, and very highly trained, I might add. Now I look back on it, very highly trained, because of subsequent events proves that out. We didn't want to go to the Surreys, and eventually we were told to change all our flashes. This happened within another 3 days, and we were told that we were going back to our regiment, which has now been transferred, the rest of the regiment transferred to in Essex. It'll come
Colchester.
To me.
Colchester?
No, Colchester. Just out, just not so. It'll come to me in a minute. And not far from North London in Essex. And as I say, it's gone out of my mind. I'm sorry about that. It'll come to me in a minute. And then I'll retrack on this. Because while we were at Canterbury, we were told by the sergeant, that's the way they used to talk to you in that way, had us all on the square. He said that you're an absolute shower, just like Terry Thomas would be, you know. And this sergeant, I think, making fun of other people's afflictions, I think he had a slight hair lip, a little taunt like that. And he used to call us all to attention. He used to say, praise, you know, sort of. to stop laughing. And he said, an absolute shower. Well, on the contrary, he looked like a sack of potatoes compared to us, because, so talk about the pot calling the kettle black, we had been in the Rhine Army, and we did a lot of parades. The Royal Fusiliers, incidentally, at that time, the Sergeant Major was Sergeant Major Scrooby, only a short man. But a regimental sergeant major, severe wasn't the word. And he used to have these parades, and I'm retracking now. And I've been running to the guard room in double quick time, in very quickly, in other words, because I happened to move my head just very slightly. As you know, the Royal Fusiliers wore a white hackle in those days, and it moved slightly on parade. He'd say, you, in, out. And he used to train his regiment, they're talking about drill now, to such a degree that they mounted a guard which represented the British Army at that time. The smartness was such that they beat the Brigade of Guards at being smart at that time. That is well known, incidentally, documented in the regiment archives. One of the smartest regiments in Germany. I didn't go on this one, but they selected a group to be the escort guard for the ceremony of the unknown soldier in Paris, you know, on the Paris Guard. they represented the British Army at that time. So we, all our uniforms had all been taken out like chocolate soldiers. They absolutely immaculate, our first uniform. And I mean, immaculate wasn't the word. And we were all very proud of this at that time, you know. None of us probably saw like the Ruddy Army, but at least we were very proud of being, you know, smart as we were. And he took the mickey out of saying we were absolute shower, but of course, the funny people said he looked worse than we did. And there's one particular story, if I may tell you this. He called us all to attention. He said, "It's been brought to the attention, my attention," he's regimental sergeant major, "that you fusiliers have been in the town in Canterbury, in the pubs, drinking and effing and swearing and carrying on and what have you. Some of us obviously were, some of us were just went for a quiet drink." You know how it was. Some, there's always the one or two who's going to kick up a bit of trouble. And he said, "From now on, I don't want to hear any more effing swearing." Of course, he couldn't help swearing himself. He's part of the England's effing this, effing that. And the rear row just fell about in laughter. He realised that he was out of control of the situation, and he said, "Parade, sure." He said, "I don't want to hear any more of this effing and swearing from now on when you go into town, otherwise you'll all be sort of confined to barracks." And he said, "Parade, Shun, dismiss, and over the fish and chip shop," which was just across the road in those days. We were stationed in the old barracks in Canterbury, not the new ones. I've incidentally been there to a regiment of weekends, and it's different than it used to be. This was the old Wellington barracks, which were, oh, terrible barracks, you know. And on parades, I don't think they liked us, or they wanted to keep us in barracks, because we were on a draft and they weren't sure what they were going to do with us, and they wanted to keep tabs on us, and they couldn't train us any more, I suppose, than what we'd already been trained. We were all highly trained being in the Rhine Army, and when they used to have parades, you know, kit inspections, they would come in and they'd throw all the big windows open and they'd go down one side and sling all the kit out the windows. Terrible, manky, terrible, terrible. And some of it was immaculate, but it was just the way they would do things. You may think this is a terrible criticism of the British Army, and an officer or my seniors might say, "Well, that's not strictly true," or it sounds a bit like a bit of an exaggeration. But no, it's perfectly true. And you've got one or two other fusiliers will tell you these things. One of the idiosyncrasies of the British Army, love it or hate it, but anyway, I must go back to, we eventually joined our battalion over here. The place I was trying to think of begins with a B, south in Essex here.
Brentwood.
And then we were put on leave, and my family, who lived in Muswell Hill in those days, in fact the whole family lived there, not only my stepmother's, my father remarried, my stepmother's parents were living there, and big house, and we all lived in the same house. And I think they said to me, they said we had constant scares that we were going to be posted abroad, and we'd come home with 24 hours posting weekend. We also did training at Brentwood at the same time, and constant training, because the army is always like that, in those days it was. And we were sent home for maybe 24 hours or leave. And we'd hitch our way home to North London. I've got some hilarious stories about that, but that's another story. We'd get home to North London, and I'd stay the night and go back the weekend sort of thing. And they used to say, my family used to say, that I wish my family here now, because they could tell you this in their own words, that they said goodbye to me five times before, as the final time, with tears, that I was being posted abroad to active service, and they didn't know what was going to become of me, especially in Korea, because at that time it was known as the Unknown War, and it was so far away. I don't think a lot of people in this country really grasped what it was all about. At any rate, I don't think we did. We were just went because that was our duty, and that's what it was expected of us. And anyway, we my final time, they didn't believe it. But eventually, I said, I'm now going, and we were shipped out on the Empire Halidale from Liverpool. And the regiment went out, the entire 1st Battalion went out on the Empire Halidale. Incidentally, I've got pictures of that here. And the regiment has pictures of that in the archives. We had training on boat, on board, always training all the time, and scrubbing decks as well, what have you. I was one of the lucky ones in being headquarter company. We were put in a series of cabins, which I don't know if it was any better on the troop ships of those time, because they're pretty foul, but they were a bit claustrophobic. And going through the Bay of Biscay, through the Med at that time, the reefs could be pretty rough, and a lot of fellows were very sick, and what have you. At any rate, it was an experience, and the Mediterranean and the Suez Canal and the Indian Ocean, and being allowed shore leave at Aden and Singapore and Hong Kong was an experience in itself. Now I come to look back on it, I was very fortunate that we were able to go to those places, although it was all very new to us and all very strange. And one felt, although you were part of a regiment, you very much felt on your own. You're away from your families and isolated to a certain degree in that sense. There's comfort in that you were in the 1st Battalion, and because you're all highly trained, you knew, like a lot of British soldiers, that you were, because you were highly trained, you'd be bulletproof, as it were, or untouchable. Being highly trained, of course, is like the rest of them were, is an advantage, because when you do get into active service, all the things that you thought were silly come to fruition, and you're then placed where you've got to use all the things you've been taught to look after yourself. And you do that because the regiment expects you to look after yourself. You don't go out and make a fool of yourself. You do carry out what you've been taught, just do your duty. Anyway, we when we docked at Hong Kong, one of my family wrote to me and they said, do look up my my aunt's sister's brother, who'd been in the last war out in the Far East. He was a commission officer, and he had come out of the army and taken the job looking after the stores for the British families, like Waitrose, in Hong Kong. So I looked him up. And he took the time off and took me all over Hong Kong and Hong Kong Island, and in his little car. And then and on the return, anyway, it's all very strange, and these foreign places, what have you. Some impressed me more than others. Some, like Aden, were terribly hot and dirty, and you wished, in a way, it's nothing like your own country. Eventually, after we went through the, gradually the idea of this, I suppose in those days, they fly everyone everywhere now, in those days you would be acclimatised as you came through to your original destination on the boat. It got hotter and hotter, the climate changed all the time, especially going through the Indian Ocean. And Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as it was then, we had shore leave there. Eventually we landed at Pusan. This was in July in 1952, if I remember rightly. It's in the archives of the British of our regiment.
What impression did Pusan create on you?
When we docked, it's all very busy and everything's sort of happening and going on. The funniest thing that happened to me, and there's other fusiliers who will relate this tale, some won't remember it because it all seems vague. Some people remember odd things for an apparent reason, but the American Army had an all-black, I think they're all-black, most of them anyhow, all-black marine band, and they greeted us on the shore from the Empire Hadadale, played us in, and then we were formed up, we were marched through Pusan, which was looked pretty devastated, to say the least, and dumps of arms all over them, big dumps of tanks and guns and American Army dumps and what have you, and looked as though it had seen better days, to say the least, had been a bit shot up. Seoul was even more so. We got into Seoul, that was badly knocked about. Because, as you know, capital careers further up, and had been gone over many times, advance and retreat, what have you, during the Korean period of Korean War. And Pusan, and I remember the sergeant running along by the side of us and said, "March like British soldiers, not like Americans," because the American band was playing like Glenn Miller style, our tunes and their tunes, and some of the Londoners, being Cockneys, were marching along in a very sort of ambling fashion to like the Americans, and I thought, this is a great laugh, you know. Anyway, sergeant running along saying, "Come on, march like British soldiers, you know, what have you, got to keep you in line, whatever the situation," as they did in those days. From there, we were shipped through Seoul by lorry, what have you. When we landed, we were collected together. I don't know what time this was, but we were all formed up and on a big mound in this collection area. The top officers, commanding officers at that time, I think one of them addressed me, was American, and he said to us that you go on training, and in so many words, he said that you can take out of this what you like, this remark. I don't know how we viewed it at the time. Some would view it, "Oh, well, we'll do just that," or others felt, "Well, I'm not going to do that." But he said that you come to a very harsh country. This country will make or break you. And he said, some of you will not come back. So my suggestion to you is, when you have any leave, is to go and enjoy yourself to the utmost. Because he said, unfortunately, being in a wartime situation, some of you, I regret, will not come back out of this. So, in other words, he was telling us to be good soldiers. And some of them, obviously, were trying to do as much as they can on leave too. They thought possibly there wasn't a chance of them coming back. I was a bit more optimistic than that. And I thought, well, if I do my job well, keep my nose clean, what have you, pray to God, as it were. I wouldn't suggest that I'm over-religious, but certainly in my family. But I think we all, whatever, whether you're religious or not, practicing Christian or not, you've got a certain amount of faith. And you have to have faith. Otherwise, if you're on your own in a situation out on patrol, you've got to feel that I'm going to come through this somehow or another. I felt, well, I look forward to the time when I do my duty, I'm released, and I go home to my family in England. And I think most of us felt that. You know what I mean? Complete your duty and then get home, you know? As a matter of fact, I was kept on for a while because being, and this sounds a bit old hat or over the top or swinging a lamp, as they say, but I was told, but it's quite, I've no reason to doubt this is perfectly true.